So, well, after Cord has presented you stuff about the Unternehmertum, we'll be diving back into social computing, social gaming. Two organizational remarks. So the first one, we are heading towards an acceptable number of participants in the exercise, but nevertheless, I would urge anybody that is somehow willing to really try and participate, because, it's somehow easy money, right? So the amount of work in correlation to the amounts of mark-wise benefits should really be an attractive deal, and we hope for an even more participants there, right? So I'd really recommend you to do this, also for the sake of the exercise, of course, and the insights connected to that. So last time we ended up discussing a second form of group models, or a second way to arrive there with the help of graph clustering. Okay. And all of the social network analysis techniques are described in that green network analysis book, which I linked you on Piazza. Once again, the e-text is free. And what's also nice is that this book contains, as the second chapter, a 5-page introduction to basic stuff about graphs. So for those that forgot about discrete Strukturen, this is the place to go, right? And then there is these three chapters, one about centrality, the other one about dense network prototypes, and the third one about graph-based clustering techniques. So that's that, right? And as always, there is exactly, more or less exactly, one text that you should refer to when dealing with these things. So in addition to that, we had one or two papers, which I recommend you to read, by Mark Newman. And that's that, right? So for those out there listening to the recordings, this should do the trick. If you don't want to come to the lecture, which is absolutely fine. Now today, what we will be dealing with is, well, metric clustering. So classic data mining, if you want, right? So we talked about that social computing is a very broad field, which has its relations to a lot of fields in computer science, sociology, also in theory, right? So the graph, the network analysis book is predominantly written by theoretical computer scientists. And I once again mentioned Sven Kosup, who's an excellent theory guy doing all these network analysis things. So if you're interested in the theory of that, maybe we should arrange for a thesis in connection with him, okay? Now, in many cases, we're not bound to this discrete representation only, but we'll have things, and we'll see that on the next slide, that allow us to put into action normal clustering techniques, normal in the sense of what you might have encountered previously, right? So as for the background reading of this slide set, so there is basically for the first three quarters, I think the slides should perfectly suffice, because there's a lot of literature out there and a lot of thick books about data mining that I don't necessarily would like you to read, because that takes a lot of time. So in the end, we'll be dealing with a machine learning technique as a simple example for machine learning, especially for the game students. It is maybe an interesting thing. So this is to read another supportive chapter, right? So this last part is taken out of Chris Bishop's machine learning book, which you might have come across one or the other, right? It's an excellent book, nice to read. And this contains about 30 pages of introduction on probability theory, right? So I know that the games engineering students don't have discrete Wahrscheinlichkeitstheorie in their curriculum, right? And once again, if you would like me to give one or two lectures about that, please indicate that on Piazza, and I'll be fine with doing that. For if that should not be the case, as in the last years, because it smells like additional load, right? You can still refer to these pages in Chris Bishop's book, because here this is a no-nonsense, no-bullshit introduction into the very basic things from probability theory. And I will try to explain everything that we need here in this lecture as well, right? So that's that, right? And I really recommend that as a background reading for this chapter. So now, in the lecture about graph clustering and also in the other social network analysis chapters, in most cases we used simple graphs, simple networks, right? But remember that we had this more elaborate model of a social network in one of the earlier lectures where we said, okay, in social networking, social media, and also social games, there's a lot more information that we know than just that there is an edge between two nodes. So there's edge profiles telling you something about the nature, the ontological nature, or some weights with respect to social relations or any other relation. One example could be the well-known tie strength, right? So how strong is your social relation to another person? And that would be part of the edge profile. Naturally, what we've also seen is that nodes have profiles, and these we call, well, profiles, right? That's what you have in Facebook and Tinder and all the other places around the social web. And these profiles tell people, well, are a matter of self-representation, and they contain a lot of different data, right? And, well, there's a lot of personal data, name, age, gender, role descriptions, interests, skills, whatever, and also contextual data, such as location, velocity, and it might also even contain things as the current emotional state, right? Availability, such as in Skype, are you semi-available or not available at all, whatever. And edge profiles, as we've seen, might also contain time-dependent data. So speaking of tie strength, that's certainly a characteristic of a long-term social relation, but the instantiation record in terms of when did I meet that person, when was that social relation instantiated in action, can also be kept in edges and edge profiles, and all other information of the short-term nature, like social situations, their social signal processing aspects, and so on. Okay. Now, using all this data to find clusters is what traditional data mining is at least partly concerned with, right? So we're switching from these discrete graph-like representations to representations of data, usually in metric spaces, where we can employ clustering algorithms, for example. And you know, in general, there is several scales that you can use to measure these profile data. Nominal scale, which allows basically for comparing things for equality or inequality, and does not allow things to be compared or added or subtracted or multiplied. And typical data from a nominal scale are names, okay? Then there's the ordinal scale of data, ordinally scaled data that allows for comparisons such as larger than or smaller than or all these things. For example, marks, right? So marks are typically ordinally scaled data. Then we have interval scale data, which allows to add or subtract, which is, for example, the Celsius scale of temperature, right? But interval, so you can say today it is 5 degrees colder than yesterday. That makes sense. So it's makes sense to subtract, for example, or to talk about intervals. That's why these things are called interval scale. And, but what it does not allow is to say that if today it is 20 degrees and yesterday was 10 degrees Celsius, you cannot say that today is twice as warm as yesterday. that doesn't make sense, right? Because there is no absolute reference point, at least non-physically especially valid one, right? Because that's what we have there. This, in order to say things like that, you need to have a proportional scale, right? So in, if you use the Kelvin scale for temperature, which has a well-defined, physically well-defined absolute zero, then you can say 100 degrees Kelvin is half as warm as 200. But at least it can make sense as its critiques, okay? So many of these profile elements that we talked about are on a proportional or interval scale. And many are represented in a metric space, right? So a metric is a mapping from two elements of the space to the real numbers, which can be used to measure the distance between two values, right? And it needs to have these mathematical properties to be a metric, especially the triangle inequality, right? Now you might say, good, it's clear to me what a location or a velocity in a metric space is, and it's also clear to me what it means to say my friend is 100 meters away from me, right? That's clear, and you can do clustering on these data as well, which might give you quasi-groups, because the people that are close by are not necessarily socially related, but in some cases they are, right? And you would have to see in your application whether this makes sense, right? However, it might not be totally clear to everybody how you would represent something as a textual element into a metric space. And there is a lot of possibilities to do so. And the most classic way is to use so-called TF-IDF features, right? Term frequency times inverse document frequency. And if I take, for example, the text, I like to dance samba, bake pizza, watch TV, plant trees in the garden, I also like to bake cakes, which might be a profile statement indicating interests, you can just say, okay, I have the English vocabulary. So the active English vocabulary consists about, let's say, in order of magnitude, 10,000 words. Some say 30,000, but in the end, it's O of 10 to the 5, right? So you have a 10,000 dimensional vector, and each count in this vector just counts the number of plane occurrences of that word in the text. So for example, if we take a cut out of this 10,000 dimensional vector, and in this case it has, well, you can count that some 15 dimensions or so, and it would just count the number of occurrences, and that would be a term frequency vector, right? You can also multiply these entries, these term frequency entries here, by the so-called inverse document frequency. And that's defined as the logarithm of this expression here. So in the numerator, it's the number of document where this term occurs divided by the total number of documents, right? And how can we read that, right? So if a word occurs in all of the documents, right, it is certainly not a good discriminator in the sense of that it can discriminate one sense from another sense, right? So, for example, there are words like I or to or and, which occur in almost all the documents, right? So that's why their inverse document frequency should be very low, right? So they should be pushed down in terms of their weights, right? There's another technique to remove them at all right from the beginning, and that's called stop word removal, right? So words, all these personal pronouns and or, and these things can be removed right from the start, because usually in that setting they don't convey any true semantics, okay? But that's a process that's not always employed. Think, for example, of about the word can, right? It's a typical verb auxiliary sometimes that, well, turns up to be there in almost all the texts, right? But if you just remove can, You might also remove other senses, like if you have a can in a text about waste management, where a can might be the central term, right? And so stop word removal is not without controversy, right? But in the end, what you can see is that we switch from a text to some vector space, namely some the number of words dimensional real valued vector space, right? Together with all the nice metrics that we have in there. Now the question is, how do we compute such clusters in metric spaces? So first of all, some notations. So our basic notation for the clustering will just be taken over, right? So a clustering in here in graph clustering was just a partitioning of the set of nodes into non-empty subsets, which we called clusters, right? Here it is now more appropriate to say that a clustering is a mapping of our metric space into an index set, right? So we have some metric space. Is there something like that? Yeah, maybe we can use that. Nice yellow. Crazy shit. So we have the R2, for example, and we have some point in R2. And now we map each point in our metric space to an index, right? And we say, for example, that this point belongs to cluster number one and this point belongs to cluster number two, right? So that's a simple mapping, which you could also you could also take over this notation here, but then you have an infinite number of points that you need to partition, but this is also somehow valid. Again, clusterings can be exclusive or non-exclusive. That is something that would also have been possible in graph clustering. So that means that if something is exclusive, a point can be a member of one cluster only. If it's non-exclusive, a point can be a member in many clusters. And that would be the case for social applications, because when you want to find groups, the typical case is that you're a member of several groups, right? That's what social identity theory tells us. Clusterings can be crisp or fuzzy, where crisp means that we have each point associated with a cluster in total or not, right? So there's nothing in between. Whereas fuzzy clustering can also imply that, for example, a certain point is a member of a certain class to 50% or to 20%, right? Sometimes this can be a good modeling for example, if you model interests, right? Because, well, I'm interested in politics somehow, right? But there's people that are more keenly interested in politics. So I'd say my interest, my membership in the politics interest cluster would be like 70%. Right? And that would be much more realistic than having these binary memberships. It can be hierarchical or non-hierarchical, and hierarchical corresponds to that dendrogram type of thing, which will also be possible here. Non-hierarchical is just a flat partitioning. Okay. Well, this is once again what we had. Exclusive and non-exclusive, hierarchical. So we have a tree structure on the CK with a subset relation between the nodes at higher and lower levels. That's just what the dendrogram is, right? And in crisp clusterings, we have a characteristic function for each cluster. So we know that, for example, for cluster number one, we can exactly say which parts of our metric space belong to that cluster number one, and these are then mapped to one, whereas all the other points that don't belong are mapped to zero. So that's called a characteristic function of the cluster as a set, right? And in a fuzzy clustering, the only thing that we have to replace is these set brackets by the interval brackets, right? So we have a fuzzy membership function that takes a point and maps it to something in between a degree alpha in 0 or 1. So I'm, for example, in my case, I'd say the politics or me as a profile, I'm member of the politics cluster to a degree 70%, right? That would be that, okay? Now, what we had in graph clustering was this single link and complete link clustering, if you remember that, right? So single link would compute the dendrogram in a very optimistic setting, saying that once things are connected coming up from the threshold graph, then we'll immediately take it as a new cluster. So it would be about merging. And complete link would be very pessimistic and say, I only merge two clusters if they had been cliques and now together form a new clique, right? And the same thing can be done in the graph clustering case as well, right? So it is, so in single link and complete link clustering, we had hierarchical clusterings because they produced dendrograms. They were crisp, right? Because they were just, partitions of the set of nodes into clusters, and they were non-overlapping, right? Now, the cost function, the local cost function that decided which existing clusters at a certain level in the dendrogram to merge was in the single link case the minimum distance and in the complete link case the maximum distance. And the distance was computed with respect to graph paths, right? And now the distance would be computed just with respect to metrics in the metric space, right? So the distance between any two clusters for the single link case, yeah, or the cost function that I take to decide which ones to merge, is just the minimum of all the points in the clusters, and this is just the normal vector norm, for example, right? So, or any other metric. And in complete link, you just replace that with the maximum. And you would proceed in exactly the same way. So there are algorithms that work well for both domains, obviously, right? So that's the metric variant of single and complete link cluster. Now, but there is more intelligent ways to make use of the metric, right? And one very, very simple clustering algorithm is k-means clustering. Okay? So who has heard of k-means clustering before? Who has never heard of this? Okay, so that's about half of the persons. So what you do in the k-means clustering is that, you optimize a objective function. And once again, in graph clustering, we came across these objective functions as well, right? So these were just objective functions that formalized our clustering desire, maximize intra-cluster coherence at the same time as maximizing intra-cluster decoherence, okay? That is what we would want, okay? And in k-means, the objective function is just formalizing the intra-cluster coherence to be maximized. Okay, and how do you do that? So each cluster is described by a cluster prototype, and that cluster prototype is denoted by mu k. Right. So each ck has a prototype, and that is a point representing the cluster. Right. So if I have my space again, I don't know why they put this paper onto these things. Crazy, right? And I have these clusters, right, of a lot of points. And each cluster is represented by its, well, center, as we will see, which acts as a prototypical representation for that cluster, and that's this mu k, right? And obviously, the intra-cluster coherence can be modeled by the average distances of data points to the center of their cluster, right? The smaller this distance is on average, the more coherent is the cluster. That's clear, because a cluster like that, with a center like that, would be way less coherent than a cluster which lies very compactly around the center, right? So that's why we say our objective function is just this averaged distance of the patterns from their respective cluster centers, right? But before we get that, we must say something different or something, an additional fact. And the question is, if I have some point and I have these two cluster centers, to which cluster does that new point belong? And the answer is, it belongs to that cluster where the distance to its center is minimal, right? So that's the rule, how you decide how to attach any point in the space to a cluster, right? So the clustering of Xn is the index Ka of the respective cluster where the distance is minimal compared to all the other cluster index centers. And here it should read K and not I. This is a mistake on the slides that I'll correct, right? So replace that with a K. Yeah. Good. Now, what we want is we want to optimize intra-cluster coherence. So this is our objective function. Let's look at it more closely, right? So first of all, we need to sum over all clusters that we have, right? So the index of large K clusters runs from 1 to large K. Large K is the number of clusters that we have. And naturally, in order to grasp this notion of cluster compactness, we need to sum distances from data points to their respective cluster center. And that's why this summation here runs only about the elements of the respective clusters. So here, for example, if we have k equal to 5, yeah, we know that we're in this inner sum, we're only dealing with cluster number 5. Right? And we're summing over all patterns that belong to that cluster. And belonging is decided again about by minimal distance. Right? And for all of these, we just sum up the distances. So we can neglect, if I say average distance, we can neglect dividing by the total number of points in that cluster, because that would just give a constant factor here before the sums, right, in the end. Good. And, well, optimizing an objective function, if I use the very simple way of gradient optimization, the only thing I have to do is I have to choose my cluster centers in a way that this measure is just optimized, right? So I have a set of points which look like this, maybe. And then I can say, well, how do I choose my centers such that the respective centers lie in a way that the overall measure is minimal, right? Because that's, or maximal in that case. No, minimal. Yeah. We want that to be minimal by saying that I'm optimizing the intra-cluster coherence. Okay, and obviously you must set the centers somewhere like this. And if you would set the centers like this, the distance, the average distance would be much larger. Okay, that's the simple optimization that takes place. And if you compute the gradient with respect to these mu k's, then you would see that the mu k's are just the centers of the respective clusters if I use this rule for assigning them to the centers, right? So this is just an exercise in calculus, compute gradient, right? So you might say, well, this looks like a normal derivative. Can I derive with can I compute the derivation with respect to the derivative with respect to a vector? Yeah, well, more mathematically, more correct would be to write the gradient with respect to mu k of j, right? So each component has to be derived, okay? And you set this equal to zero, and then you see that this will be the result, right? So the cluster prototypes should be chosen as the centers of gravity of their respective clusters. Now, this is the algorithm just for reference, right? And this is the algorithm in action, right? So we start here in the upper left corner, and the green points are our patterns that we have, right? And this is the two, the R2, which is our metric space. Now we start by choosing the cluster centers in a random fashion, right? And the next step would then be to compute the cluster assignments according to this random assignment of the cluster centers, right? Now, we have a blue and a red cluster. Now, the respective cluster assignments are like that, right? So all the blue points have a smaller distance to the blue center than to the red center, and all the red points have a smaller distance to the red center than to the blue center. Right? And in the next step, I recompute my cluster centers as the centers of gravity with that formula of my new clusters. Because now I have a cluster assignment. The red dots form a cluster and the blue dots form another cluster. Now I can compute their center anew. And this results in this blue center and this red center. And then I can do the next step and reassign the points to the new cluster centers, which would give this blue and red division, compute the new centers, compute the new assignments, new centers, new assignments, and you would see that this very quickly converges. And this is also called alternating optimization, or with a more mathematical term, expectation maximization. In the end, and this is how you can quickly numerically solve for that, which is very convenient. It takes 5, 6, 7 steps to arrive at something that's very stable. Now, one thing that might have come to your mind in all of that discussions is, how do we magically find the number of clusters? And that should be a large k up to there, not a small k, right? So, who tells us that we have two clusters? Well, obviously, in that toy example, you say, well, even a blind man or a blind woman can see that there are two clusters, right? But how would I know? If I have a 100-dimensional space, I don't have a chance to really plot that and look at the data, right? But looking at the data is a technique that's not so bad, especially if you have spaces that are manageable in terms of visualization, right? But if you really have to deal with a 100-dimensional space, or as in case of the texts and their representations, a 10,000-dimensional space, you wouldn't know how many clusters there are actually out there, right? And, well, determining the number of clusters is the most interesting problem, basically, in clustering, because in classification, you know how many classes you want, because this is something that you have in your training data, right? If you don't have any training data, if we're in the realm of unsupervised learning as here, right, we don't know, okay. And one technique is to just try out, right? So you have the objective function, which is this, right? This is the objective function that you want to optimize. And you can just try that out, run the algorithm for several k's, Yeah? Try them all out from 1 to 1,000 and see which one gives the best performance in terms of your optimization criterion, your target function, right? One idea could also be to use one function for the actual clustering and another target function that also formalizes the clustering paradigm to determine K, right? This could be another idea. And there are, as in graph clustering, there is tons of these functions that all aim at modeling the clustering paradigm, all with different techniques, right? So there are entropy-based indices that would just make use of entropy as a measure. I explained to you in the beginning of the lecture sometime, if I remember correctly, and others, right? And one of them is, for example, Dunn index. And the Dunn index is just another way to state the objective function, okay? And the Dunn index is this more or less complicated formula, which we will analyze, right? So there is, in the innermost part, there is this expression here, D1 over max D2, right? And D1 is precisely the distance function from single link clustering, right? So that is the minimum of the distance of any two points in any two clusters, right? And this is just that from single link. D2 would be the diameter of a cluster, which is pessimistically defined as the maximum of, yeah, well, or not realistically, I should say, which is the maximum distance of any two points in the cluster, right? And if I set this into proportion, I'd say what I want is I want the clusters to be as compact as possible, right? So D2 should be small for each cluster, while D1 should, in essence, be as large as possible for all the clusters, because D1, in a sense, formalizes inter-cluster separation and D2 intra-cluster compactness, okay? And I'm taking the minimum over any such cluster K1 or K2 to be, again, very pessimistic, right? And this would then be an objective function that I would like to maximize, yeah, which I can use, right? And I can compute this again for a lot of different K's and see which K gives the best value, and that would be the one that I choose. And again, single link clustering is here called by this acronym single agglomerative hierarchical non-overlapping clustering. That's why this is called by that acronym. Okay. And as I said, there is a lot of other indices, and which one you choose depends on what you would like to model. But in the end, they all model the clustering paradigm. Well, that's K-means, and it's very popular. It's still used out there, but it has some drawbacks, right? And drawbacks of K-means we will get to in a second. So how can we apply K-means? So let's assume you would like to cluster people with respect to their current whereabouts, right? And, well, this can somehow make sense if you, let's say, want to do some social medium or a game, with, let's say, with respect to a concert that's going on, right? So AC/DC was there the other week, right? How do you find all the people in the AC/DC concert? So you can just compute a clustering, and hopefully those people would end up in a cluster, okay? And, well, the question is that a socially relevant cluster? Maybe yes, maybe no, right? In general, how can we distinguish socially relevant clusters, so group candidates, from quasi-groups, right? Well, what you can do is several things. So you can watch people, and that's, well, with all bytes, you have to regard privacy there, of course. You can compute the clusterings over a period of time, and groups that keep on reappearing are potential candidates for socially relevant clusters, okay? Or groups or clusters that appear periodically, because that would indicate a rhythm of life or something. What you can also do is you can establish thresholds, right? Because if we know that the actual diameter of a cluster that we found is 600 meters, we know that the probability that this is socially relevant is small, right? So the example with the concert is a counterexample to that, because you then say, I accept clusters of a diameter of, let's say, 500 meters, because that I'm after finding all the concert visitors. But usually a true social group with an exchange, a face-to-face social exchange between people, must be limited to the social perception range of people. And that's certainly within a few tens of meters, or even below 10 meters, right? Because if you, for example, watch settings like the networking slide that Kurt presented you with respect to the Unternehmertum networking session, you would find that people stand in groups, and the groups are as compact as, let's say, 2 or 3 meters, right? Everything beyond that range is not socially valid. That has to do with social perception and also with interpersonal distances, something that we will also investigate later on, okay? Other thing would be to include velocities, for example. So if two people are really close by but have a velocity vector that just shows in different directions, obviously they're about to split apart, right? So you can just expand your space from 2D location coordinates to 4D configuration space with velocities as an additional dimension. And then in these spaces, clusters might have more meaningful meaning than if you would just use the clustering. However, K-means has its cons. And one of the cons is that due to this construction with the minimum distance, K-means tends to favor spherical clusters. Okay, so if you have elongated banana-shaped clusters like a trail of soldiers moving or something, then this wouldn't be a good clustering algorithm. Another drawback, which is the drawback of almost all clustering algorithms except for the one that's described below, is that you have to know the number of clusters before you start computing. So if you use the tryout technique, this can be computationally expensive, right? And what you also don't have is a notion of noise, right? So if you have some point that lies far away from the others, right, it would still maybe severely influence the location of the cluster centers, but in essence, it's just noise, yeah? So what we need to have is a noise robust algorithm. And one alternative that has been developed at LMU Informatics by a professor that's still active there. Sorry, I don't have his name, I think. No, I'll have to look that up. But, and that one is called DBScan. And the idea is as follows. So you have two parameters. One parameter that specifies the minimum number of points in a certain neighborhood that you would like to see in order to call that a cluster. And then an epsilon that would also contribute to modeling the density of the cluster. And this works as such, right? So I would choose some pattern that I have not seen before, and this pattern we call X, right? So let's take this red dot here as the new pattern, right? And then what I would compute is the epsilon neighborhood of that point. So everything that is closer to that point than epsilon, right? And for example, in the epsilon neighborhood of this point, we would find this, 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 and this, okay? And if there are more than or at least min pt many points in that neighborhood, then I would say, well, this smells like a cluster. So I start a new cluster. I would include my original x and all of its neighboring points. And then I would iterate through all of these and compute their neighborhoods as well, right? So I started with this x, then I would iterate and say, what about this point? Then I also compute its neighborhood, right? And then I would see, oh, well, there are these points in there, but I've already have them in my cluster, right? What about this point, right? I have this, this, and this in there, right? But maybe if min pt is set to 4, I would not include those that are not part of this cluster yet, namely this yellow one, into my cluster, right? Or I could say if min pt is, for example, 3, I might include it in the cluster, but again, if I'm done with that, I don't find any more, so I'm restricted to that, right? And the advantage is that points that are very far away from the others can be designated noise because there are not enough points in the epsilon neighborhoods. And the great advantage of that is that obviously we don't need to know our k in advance, right? We can have arbitrarily shaped clusters, so even toroidal ones, yeah, like wheel-shaped clusters, and we have a notion of noise, right? Drawback is, instead of k, we somehow need to guess our parameters min, pt, and epsilon correctly, right? Because otherwise, you would end up having one large cluster, right? Because everything, if you are too optimistic, then everything would be drawn into one cluster. If you're too pessimistic, again, this would be too shattered, right? So you have to choose both things in an elegant way, which is kind of hard in high-dimensional spaces, right? So do you have an intuition about that? Once again, you're drawn back to trying out, okay? And since there is no objective function, you would have to determine the cluster quality by some objective function again. So this is not the holy grail per se, right? In the original DB scan algorithm, you would have one fixed min, pt, and epsilon. But what about cases where we have denser regions and sparser regions, right? Could be the case in a game, right? You have, let's say, two or three clusters which are very dense, and you have some which are on the move, some clans which are on the move in your virtual world, and which have a higher density. But in the original algorithm, you have to choose one pair of parameters for all of your whole space. And there are adaptive versions of DBSCAN, new versions that would be able to adapt to different densities, but again, at the price of having a more complicated algorithm. Good. So that was DBSCAN. So now we have two algorithms, right? K-means and DBSCAN, which work well and can do the trick for a lot of things. However, both of them were CRISP clustering algorithms, right? So each point is uniquely attached, or not uniquely. Each point is exactly member of a cluster or not, fully member or not. What about if we would like to have gradual memberships? Right? And for example, if you're interested in interests and you just want to cluster profiles with respect to interests, then gradual or fuzzy membership to an interest cluster is the rule and not the exception. Now, how can we do that? And we will see that it's surprisingly simple. So first, what we need is a reformulation of k-means that would allow for switching over to the fuzzy case. And that works like this. So remember our object function for k-means. That was that. Okay. So we summed over the clusters. And inside here, we need to sum over all the patterns in each cluster. Right? So this makes it necessary to formulate it with this complicated set index notation down there. Right? It's maybe more elegant to formulate it in just the same way by using a so-called membership matrix, RNK. Right? So RNK, so N is the index that counts the patterns. Right? So I have N patterns, endpoints in my whole data set. And k is the index that counts the clusters. So small k runs from 1 to large k. Right? And RNK is 1 if pattern XN is actually in cluster CK. And it's 0 if this is not the case. Okay? So once again, RNK is 1 if pattern N is in cluster K. And RNK is 0 if pattern N is not in cluster K, right? This makes it possible or allows for reformulating our objective function in precisely that way, right? So we still have the summation over the clusters, that's clear. And we also have the summation over patterns, but now we don't have this set thing here. We just dumbly sum over all the patterns that we have. So we have large N patterns. And our membership matrix RNK takes care of this association. Because for those that are not members of the respective cluster, RNK would be zero, and then we wouldn't have any contribution to the sum, right? So this is exactly the objective function for k-means. Once again, if we do the optimization, so compute the gradient with respect to mu k, we would have our well-known k-means back, right? So in k-means, what we had was we found that the cluster centers are just the Barry centers of, or the centers of gravity of the respective cluster. And this expression here can also be reformulated in terms of the membership matrix. And this would yield this, right? So in order to have this 1 over CK, which just counts the number of patterns that are in cluster CK, I now sum over the columns of the membership matrix. Right? This gives me exactly this number of patterns here in the cluster, which is this. And in order to sum up something like all the patterns that are in this cluster, all these xn, I can use the same trick with multiplying the membership matrix. So this is my expression for mu k. What I need here is my non-overlapping constraint. So for all patterns, we have one index k where we have exactly one value of RNK, which is 1, and all the others are 0. So this is the crisp clustering that is in action for k-means. Okay, this is the non-overlapping constraint. Now, the only modification in order to arrive at a fuzzy clustering, and then this thing isn't called k-means, it's called c-means, is by taking the power m here for this matrix, right? Seems like a rather crazy step, right? So why would we take the power m, right? Now, the reason we will see in a minute, right? So what we would see already is that in the case m equal to 1, we get the k-means case back, right? And in the case m to infinity, we would get RNK, the membership, as 1 over k, right? Can we understand that, Okay. So we will understand it more thoroughly in a second when we compute the derivatives. But already, if you multiply a matrix with itself a number of times, then you get something muddy, something averaged. Okay. This is the intuition here. And the more often you multiply this with itself, the more muddy it gets, until the end you arrive at complete fuzziness. And complete fuzziness would mean I'm interested in everything to a degree, however many everythings there are, right? So if there is K clusters, then the membership of pattern N in each of those is 1 over K. So the membership is fully spread, so nothing that is really left of the clustering. So this is the complete fuzziness, where M to the 1 is the complete crispness. Now, intuition tells us that there are values in between for M that kind of control the fuzziness, right? So this is a way like watching the pattern space with an ever coarsened glasses, right? So if the coarsening of the glass is very rough, you would just see some blurred something, right? And if the coarsening gets ever sharper, you would see the clusters in a blurred out way. This is what fuzziness is. While if the glasses are fully transparent, you would see the crisp belongings of each pattern to each cluster, right? And this is, so wearing those coarse glasses is the same as taking this power M here with respect to the membership matrix. Now, what we need to do is we would still need to compute the gradient with respect to mu k, but we would have to face these conditions, right? So for each pattern, the fuzzy membership degrees in each cluster must sum up to 1. So this is nothing but stating that if I sum for a constant pattern N over all the Ks, I must get 1, right? So my interests need to be somehow spread about over the set of interest clusters, but such that in the end I have 100% interest to spend, right? And the other one is that for each cluster, there must be at least 1 non-trivial member of it. Otherwise, this cluster has no meaning. If I have a topic like, polka dotted tulips eaten by hares, nobody has an interest in that, right? So this is a nonsensical interest cluster. Just throw it away, right? So this is the second condition here that we have. Okay. And if I do that, so the math are comparatively easy, you need to employ 2 Lagrange multipliers, compute the gradient, and give it a go. Why not try it out? This is the result. Okay. So this is the result for the cluster centers. And we see that we somehow get back our expression here from k-means, yeah? So the only difference is in k-means we had an exponent of 1, but now we have an exponent of m, but otherwise this is the same expression, right? So we still have something like the coarsened cluster gravity centers in the fuzzy case. Now the membership matrix, which is now also part of the consideration, is now given by that expression, right? And we need to investigate this a little further on the next slide, okay? Now, this result assumes that patterns and prototypes don't coincide, right? So that, because otherwise these things would become 0 and the whole expression would break down, right? So you are not allowed to take a prototype that is identical to a pattern, but that's just a thing that can be healed somehow, okay? But still, this is somehow a mystical expression, and let's investigate this. So if we take the limit m to infinity, what would happen? Okay, so going with m to infinity would take this whole expression here, this exponent to zero, obviously, right? And so this thing here would give a one, okay? And since we sum over all the clusters, this would just give R and K as equal to 1 over K. So going with M to infinity would give complete fuzziness. So something that we just stated two slides ago. And that's what we find out here. So seems to be a good modeling. Now, what about this expression, which is just the same as this one here, right? Just written a slightly in a different way. What about limit M to 1? So the statement was we get K means back. Is that true? Let's investigate it. So obviously, this one here, we sum over all the clusters, right? So, and if K prime is equal to K, we would just get a 1. So this is just drawn apart into two parts. Now, let's watch what happens in the limit M to 1. Obviously, here we have 1 minus 1, so 2 divided by 0, so that's infinity, right? And if I go with something, with a number, Q, to the power beta, and I go with beta to infinity, what happens with this expression? Well, if Q is smaller than 1, this would go to 0, right? If Q is larger than 1, this would go to infinity, right? That's what happens. So, depends, obviously, what happens on these expressions. So, if we have that the distance between the pattern in question, so we're still talking about one matrix element. So we have one pattern in question and one cluster in question. Okay. If the distance between the pattern and the cluster center is the minimum over all these distances, so if Xn is closest to its cluster center, then the first sum, so this thing here, becomes infinite. Sorry, if it's not the minimum, it becomes infinity, right? If it is the minimum, the first sum here becomes 0, and R and K is exactly 1 over 0 plus 1 is 1, right? So this means that we just have our crisp clustering criterion back, okay? So if we're having the minimum, then R and K is 1. If we're not having the minimum, R and K is 0, right? So this is exactly what happens. And why does that happen? So just think of this. So if it is not the minimum, then you would have one element here in the sum where Q is larger than 1, so it will all blow up. If it is actually the minimum, all the elements in the sum would be smaller than 1, so it will go to 0, okay? And that means we have proven what was stated here, right? That in these limits, M equal to 1, we have K means back, and in the limit M to infinity, we have complete fuzziness. So logic implies that some reasonable settings, like M equal to 2 or 3 or 4, would yield an ever more fuzzy version of the cluster. And that's a good modeling tool, right? So you can determine yourself how fuzzy you want to have it, okay? That's that. And that's this algorithm, just for the reference, as a, well, formulated algorithm. Now, still, fuzzy C-means is, well, not something that is, I would say, typically used these days. So there is more refined models that would make more sense and that you would find in real applications. And the reason is, once again, fuzzy C-means favors spherical clusters, and sometimes you have cases like that where your data more looks like something like this. Yeah, and in these cases, it might work or it might not work. However, it is maybe better to use something else. And this something else is Gaussian mixture models. Okay. Now, this is the part where Chris Bishop's book comes in, right? So for those that want to read about probability theory, please refer to the respective chapter in Chris Bishop's book. It's not very much. So not very large, I think about 30, 40 pages. Excellent introduction. And this is another chapter in Chris Bishop's book. And I scanned the pages and put them online, right? So you can just download it and read it, and you would see that this is hopefully something interesting. So I warn you that in the upcoming slides, there's a lot of math, right? And I'll try to be as well-behaved with the math as possible. But why I chose to present this algorithm to you is because I wanted you to give you an idea of what machine learning is, because machine learning these days is so central for social computing and social gaming as well, that I think it's absolutely worth to take a look at this. Okay? Good. So, as we said, fuzzy C-means is nice, but it may be better to have something more expressive. Now, what is a Gaussian mixture model? So basically, it is about linear combinations of Gaussian functions. Okay? So what we're talking about is a probability density. Okay? And you know that a probability density function, P of X, is a function that if integrated over some domain D would give you a probability, right? So what we need to have is that if we integrate this over all of your space, so something like if we are in R2, for example, P of X dx, or you can write d2x if you like, then this should give 1, right? Otherwise, it wouldn't be a probability density. And in essence, so if you draw a picture, what you have is here you have your two-dimensional space, right? And somehow you have a function that kind of formalizes your intuition, and this gives a function over that space. And if you integrate over certain domains with respect to that function, this would give you a probability, right? And what is that probability? Well, this probability can be interpreted as a cluster membership later on, but we won't have that view for the moment. It's just some function. And this is made up out of a linear combination of Gaussian functions. Okay? And the linear coefficients are denoted as pi k. And these n here are the multinomial Gaussian functions. So what is a multinomial Gaussian? Let's look at this. Okay? So for those that don't have any connection point to probability theory. So you might know from school that there is something like a normal distribution, right? So a Gauss function, right? So what this is nothing but a one-dimensional probability density function. Like this is our function, our density function P of X. And for example, if I want to know the probability that X is, so here we have X, and here we have P of X, right? And if I want to know what's the probability of X being larger than 2, all I need to do is I would have to, I would have to integrate from 2 to infinity p of x dx, and I get this area under the curve to infinity, and this is the probability of x being larger than 2. So this you need, for example, for hypothesis testing. Yeah. So if you want to prove some hypothesis, if you have a questionnaire, you would, for example, work with t-tests or something, and this would be a typical tool for that, right? So this is a one-dimensional Gaussian function, right? And this is proportional to e to the minus x squared over sigma or sigma squared. I'm a bit confused. Times some normalization coefficient, right? So e to the minus x squared is basically the shape. And obviously, this is a standard normal distribution, right? So it's basically, it has a standard width there, right? You can generalize this if you say I have x minus some mu squared over sigma squared, and I hope that it's sigma squared. Now, what is that? So this mu kind of shifts the Gaussian from its original center 0 to some center mu. And the sigma here is a measure of the width of the Gaussian, right? So you can have Gaussians that are arbitrarily shifted and squeezed or elongated according to this, right? So that's the typical Gaussian function. Now, if you have this in higher dimensions, you would still have a center that's a vector, but this would be replaced by something that we will call a covariance matrix. And if you look at this from above, then this is the result, right? So for example, in R2, the Gaussians that were simple curves now become hats, hat-shaped, bell-shaped curves, and the isolines are just these that are depicted here. So in two dimensions, you can squeeze or draw apart the Gaussian in two ways, like this and like this, arbitrarily. So that results that the isolines would then be ellipses. Okay, and you can already have a guess about why this is useful for clustering, because if I have some patterns in here and I would adequately compute the clusters as Gaussians, I'm able to adapt them to any shape I want, right? So for here, I, for example, have clusters that might look like this, right? And that would exactly model what we have. If I were to compute this with fuzzy C means, it would, as I said, favor spherical clusters. And here I can also model something that's very elongated. Right? So, for example, here we have three clusters, and each cluster is represented by a Gaussian. So there's other ways to use these Gaussian mixture models, but that's the way we want to use them for the moment. Okay. Now, one thing about notation, right? So usually, so this is a probability density, right? So all of these things together, these Gaussians, which we will investigate later on the next slide, and these linear factors form something like this surface here, right? Something like this. So all put together, you would have some landscape, which is then the probability density function here, in this case, on the R2. Good. Now, that's why it's called a probability density function. What we usually write this as is P of X given the parameters. And what are the parameters? So, well, obviously we have three sorts of parameters. So these pi's denote the relative weight of the Gaussian. How important is that Gaussian? Mu's are the centers, and the sigma are the matrices that control the form of the Gaussian, right? How squeezed or elongated or rotated it is, right? So I can have 2D Gaussians that look like this or that look like this. So this, for example, would just be a rotated version of this, and we can have this one here, which would be rotated, translated, and deformed, like this, right? And this is all controlled by this matrix here. So we have three sorts of parameters, the pi's, the mu's, and the sigma's, and they're all denoted by this theta here, right? So usually you will write this as a conditional probability saying that this is my probability density function for x given the parameters, okay? And we would, if you're into Bayesian machine learning, you would see that this notation really makes sense. Good. So the goal that we have is we have a set of patterns, and we have this parameterized, very general Gaussian mixture model expression for the probability density function P of X. Now, the only thing that we're left with in the whole lecture part is finding an optimal set of parameters such that the Gaussian mixture model is optimally adapted to the data, right? And if I find something like that, I can, for each point in my space, like for example this point, determine the membership in each cluster with a simple probabilistic expression, right? And that's why, in essence, this is a can be used as a clustering algorithm. It can also be used for classification purposes and others, but for example, in terms of speaker detection, voice activity detection or something, but this would be our application for the moment. Yes? Yes, it should sum up to one. We'll see that. Yeah, we'll see that. Okay, so this is the only thing that we need to do right now. So we're having this general model. We have our data set. So we have n data points that are somehow given, and we want to find the combination of parameters that best explains the data in a certain sense. Now, how can we do that? So from a stochastical point of view, what you usually assume is that all of these data points are the result of a random experiment. So you just reverse the story, right? So the story that we have is that the patterns are first, and we try to fit the model as a second step, right? So the patterns are reality, the model is somehow a bit fictionless, right? Now, if you reverse the story and say, if you had the model, which means I had the Gaussian mixture model, so the landscape of these connected heads, and then I sample from this distribution, I draw from it, right? So it's clear that where the probability is higher, there's a higher probability of drawing a pattern. And where the probability is very low, out here, there's a low probability of drawing a pattern, right? So if I draw n patterns from this distribution, I might get back my data set, right? If I reverse the story. And reversing the story means that I draw these things independently from another. I first draw my first pattern, then I draw the second pattern, and I draw the third, and so on, until I draw the nth pattern. And I also all draw them independently, right? Second thing, I all draw them from the same identical probability distribution, the one that I'm about to learn. Just remember that we reversed the story, yeah? So that's why always, or in most cases, the data are assumed to be identically, independently drawn from my probability distribution, which means that if I have this probability distribution for some variable small x, yeah, then I can say, what's the probability for the whole data set? Well, since they're independent as stochastic random variables and they're all drawn from the same distribution, the probability of the whole data set is just the product of the probabilities for each data point, right? And this thing we call the likelihood of the data, yeah? Or we could say it's the likelihood for the parameters, which is maybe more convenient, yeah? So, in other words, what we wanted to find the theta, the set of parameters that best explains the data. So we have given the data, and what we want is we want to maximize the probability. Now, if you say, this is my data, or let's put it like this. So we have 7 points here, and this is my data. And if I put the Gaussian somewhere here, right, the probability or the likelihood of those two Gaussians explaining that data is very small. But if I place the Gaussians like that, the likelihood of these two Gaussians explaining my data is much higher, right? So in the essence, what I'm after is I want to maximize this expression with respect to theta. That's all I want. And that's called maximum likelihood learning. That's a staple in machine learning, right? So finding the theta that best explains the data corresponds to computing the argmax of this expression, or the gradient with respect to all the parameters. And as a last remark for today, it's convenient to, instead of using the actual likelihood, it's convenient to use the logarithm of it. Why? Because taking the logarithm of this product would turn the product into a sum, and now we have just the logs of the probabilities. And the second effect is that this is numerically more convenient because probabilities can get very small, but the logarithm makes it more manageable. So this is called the log likelihood, okay? And all you want is to compute the theta that maximizes the log likelihood. So in essence, this is like our model, our objective function, and we need to kind of, once again, compute the maximum. So this is the same as we did for fuzzy c-means or fuzzy k-means, just with now a Gaussian mixture model. And why I chose the Gaussian mixture model is because it's a quite okay clustering algorithm, and the second thing, we will get to know the expectation maximization approach, which is something that's very important. And so you have a nice little compact relevant machine learning example, which tells you a lot about machine learning without having to know all the other things from the machine learning lecture. That's why I chose it. And we'll be dealing with this next Tuesday, I think. Yeah, next Tuesday. And once again, please participate in the exercise. So see you next Tuesday.